I want to ask you a question this morning. How do you evaluate wealth? How will you determine if you finally have enough to be happy? It's kind of an ongoing question, isn't it? It's a tough question, but it's a question that we're going to kind of look at in this today's chapter. James is going to kind of challenge us to think about that. So I want to ask you that question. How do you determine how much money is enough or how much you'll have to finally be happy? There was a Muslim ruler by the name of Abd al-Rahman III, who was a Muslim ruler in Spain in the 10th century. This guy had everything. They said a third of his wealth went to just running the government. A third he hoarded away in literally barns full of stuff. And the rest of it, he built these massive structures, you know, palaces and mosques. Probably don't hear him much because he's a Muslim ruler, not a Christian one, or he's in Spain and not in some of the other countries. But he made these magnificent and grand buildings. He was in the height of his heyday. He had thought he had everything, the Solomon of his day, maybe you could imagine, at least with Spain. And in his memoir, in a letter he wrote this. He made a final assessment of his life. He said, "I've now reigned above 50 years in victory or peace, beloved by my subjects, dreaded by my enemies, and respected by my allies. Riches and honors, power and pleasure have waited on my call, nor does any earthly blessing appear to have been wanting to my felicity. I've diligently numbered the days of my pure and genuine happiness which have fallen to my lot." Reigned 50 years, had everything you can imagine. How many days do you think he said he was actually happy? 14. In case you didn't know it, 70 years times 365 days is 25,550 days. And 14 of those, he had a clear assessment that he was happy. Obviously, we know this, that riches and wealth don't necessarily provide us happiness. But sometimes we can buy into that vision, that dream, that if only we had a certain amount of money or if only we had a certain amount of things, then life would be fulfilling and it would be content. We could actually find contentment. Well, I open with this story because the reality is we can buy into the same kind of thing. We can be discontent and we can be unhappy and we can kind of have sometimes the same kind of perspective. But James wants us to challenge us today. He wants us to look at our hearts and to examine them and to say, how has it that maybe we've built our happiness and our hope not on Jesus, but rather maybe about our own money or our own net worth or certain things? He's going to say some pretty bold things, some pretty blunt things, but I think it's good for us to hear. So if you can turn with me in your Bibles to James 5, we're going to actually read through 5, 1 through 12. Next week will be our final sermon in the series. It's going to look at prayer. And then starting on Easter, we're going to look at the high priestly prayer, actually, of Jesus. And so we're going to look at how Jesus prayed for himself and how that came to fruition on Easter Day. And so we like to spend some time looking at different topics, and one of the topics we think it's important is prayer, but we do it by just reading through a book of the Bible. So that's kind of what's coming up. But today we get to read James 5, verses 1 through 12. It's on page 839 in your Bibles, or you can just listen to me as I read. He says this, "Now listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that's coming upon you. Your wealth is rotted, moths have eaten your clothes, your gold and silver are corroded. Their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You've hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay, the workmen who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You've lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You've condemned and murdered innocent men who are not opposing you. Be patient then, brothers, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop and how patient he is for the autumn spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against each other, brothers, or you too will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Brothers, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you do, we consider blessed those who have persevered. You've heard of Job's perseverance and seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. And above all, my brothers, do not swear, not by heaven or earth or by anything. Let your yes be yes and your no, no, or you'll be condemned. Now, what we're going to see is actually, James is going to speak to us two different groups of people. Those who are let greed kind of rule part of their lives, and also to those who are feeling injustice. So no matter what state of life we're in, he's going to challenge us. I want to start by asking you, what image do you have of this passage, of this text? And because the reality is image is important. I might be dating myself here, but back in the late 90s, there was a series of ads by Sprite that said, image is nothing, thirst is everything, obey your thirst. Anybody else didn't recognize those ads? My personal favorite one was in this NBA lockout where Tim Duncan and Grant Hill needed to find work because, you know, those millions they had in the bank weren't enough. So they went to work for 1-800-TALL-MEN and they poked fun of themselves. Literally, you could hire Tim Duncan to change your light bulb or Grant Hill to cut your tree or to get the cat out of the gutter off your roof because they needed to earn some income. But I liked it because it poked fun of themselves and they didn't take themselves too seriously. And it communicated a good message that you don't have to take your own image that seriously. And sometimes we can get caught up in that. But the reality is that the image you have of certain things does matter. For instance, if I was to say something up here and I said it with certain tones or certain mannerisms, you would interpret it differently, right? If I said, man, you are killing it, and I said it in an upbeat and loving way, you might think, man, I'm doing really good. I'm awesome, right? I mean, that's the way that phrase can mean. It can mean that in today's vernacular, you're doing awesome, you're killing it. But if I said, you're killing it, right? You'd probably go, man, I better be quiet, right? I better not say anything. I better stop it. I better end this thing right now. The way and the image that we have of certain things can dictate how we interpret it. And so before we look at the passage, I think it's important for us to think about certain aspects of this text to make sure we interpret it correctly. And so I want to ask you, what is your image of James? I mean, I just read some pretty heavy stuff. If you look at it, I use words like condemnation and you fatten yourselves for slaughter. And so what's the image that you have of James as you read this? Well, one image some people may have is that of the bullhorn guys who are protesting against everyone. And you see James as this harsh critic who's just out to get you. But the reality is the image you should have of this text is James as a kindly grandfather, one who's been a leader of the church and a spiritual giant who has your best interest out for you, who wants to give you some grandfatherly advice about some pretty important topics. And so when you hear this, don't hear that harsh tone, but hear a grandfather who cares for you and is going to speak some pretty tough words so you get it right. Or sometimes when we hear this, when we hear you rich folks or, you know, you've lived a self-indulgent life, we can think, well, this doesn't have anything to do with me because my economic status is not really there. I'm not rich. Rich is, according to Americans, higher than everybody else above us. Literally, you can look at all the different studies that are out there. And everybody says, if you're making less than 30,000, you say, if only I could make 50 to 100,000, then I'd be rich. Those who make 50 to 100,000 say, the rich people are those who make over 100,000. And those who are rich, who will be make between 100 and 500,000 say, well, you got to make $1 million to be rich. We play this game. It's studies show it. You can see it over and over again that we somehow define rich as somebody who's bigger than I. But the reality is that you can be a greedy person who's making only $15,000 a year and you can hold on to things tightly. Or you can be wealthy by standards, literally millionaires, and you can be kind and gracious with your money. And so no matter what our economic status is, the reality is the truth that James wants to speak of here applies to us. He's talking to all of us. Not to mention, let's talk about this. The reality is you and I make more than anybody else in the world. You doubt me? log on to Odesk or Elancer or any of those freelance things and look at how much somebody from India or Pakistan or any country, even in the Eastern European country, asks for their hourly wage. It's usually $3, $5 or less. And so the reality for us is we are wealthy and we are spoken to here. And so no matter what state we think we're in, we have to get over that hurdle that, yes, this text does apply to us. But there's also something we need to talk about, and that is, what's your view of money? See, the thing is about church and money is we tend to go on different extremes, right? I don't have the image up here, but this last week I read where Creflo Dollar, a pastor in Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, asked 200,000 of his people, or 30,000 of his people, to give $200 so he could buy a $65 million jet. Yeah, because he has a health and wealth gospel approach that if you give me this, this is a blessing. Now, he wants to use it as a tool. I'm going to try not to judge him too bad, right? I mean, he wants to fly all over the United States and the world so he can promote the gospel. But to him, your wealth and your status are equal to God's blessing. And so sometimes we can think that if we don't have money, that it's a bad thing. On the flip side, we can be in churches that want to react against that and say that is completely excess. And so we got to live simply and quietly. Now, there's nothing wrong about having a private jet. There's companies that have that. But my point is we got to live within our means and we have to live in the thing that's actually needed, okay? So what the Bible wants to say is this. It teaches that money is amoral. And amoral sounds like immoral, so I want to make it absolutely clear what amoral means, okay? Amoral means that money itself is neither good or bad. It's how we use it that's important. And what you're going to find when the Bible talks about money, and I'm going to try and nuance it here in our sermon, especially in the first half, is it acknowledges that it's a complex thing, that things aren't so simple. And the reason why it's not so simple is because our hearts aren't so simple. And so money in itself is like a brick. A brick can be used to build a hospital, or it can be used to destroy a window. And money in itself is not bad. Being wealthy and privileged is not bad. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's how you use the gifts that God has given you that's really important. As I said, in the beginning, we can be stingy and only own make $15,000 a year, and you can be stingy and be a billionaire. We can be the most giving person who makes $15,000 a year, and we can have the most giving billionaire. It's not economic status or the amount of money, but rather it's what's going on in the heart. And so James wants to warn us about two different things because he sees that greed can be a destructive force. See, money in itself isn't bad, but the thing about money is that it can fuel different desires that we have. That's why money in our checkbook is a great way for us to look at where our priorities are. Money gets us power. We can buy certain things or do certain things. It gets us experiences, and it gives us a sense of control and security. And so it can tap into things that are and show us things in our hearts that maybe we don't see in other places. And so James wants to warn us in this passage about greed. And he's going to hold up to our mirror two different attitudes that can be warning signs that can impact our life. Now listen, he says, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that's coming upon you. He sees the greed has a negative impact on our lives. And I want you to see before we look at it that James isn't the only one who talks about money this way, that has this kind of negative impact. I mean, Ecclesiastes 5 verses 10 through 11 says, whoever loves money never has money enough, and whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? Again, you notice it's not money, but it's the love of money that's the source of evil, right? There's a huge distinction here that we need to be careful about and make sure we get. 1 Timothy 6, verses 7 through 11 says, "For we brought nothing into the world and can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we'll be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and trap, into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." Again, I just want you to see that James isn't the only one who speaks about money. And it's not that money's bad. It's just the desires that it fuels and it can take on a bigger role of our lives. And so James wants to give us two warning signs that we can hold up to say, is see if money can really have that kind of grip on our lives. And the first thing he says is that when greed has overtaken our lives, that we can hoard our money and our things. He says, "Your wealth is rotten and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded and their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You've hoarded wealth in these last days." And what he's saying here is this. We can approach our things and our money two different ways. One, we can hold them tightly, close-fisted to where we never want to let it go. And some of us, I'm a tightwad, so this speaks to me, right? I mean, we can hold our money tightly. On the other hand, we can hold things open-handed. We can see that it's a gift of God, that God blesses some of us with some funds. And so, but we don't hold on to it tightly. Rather, we realize that it's able to pass through us. And so that's it. And he says that when we have this attitude of closed-fistedness and we hoard things, then we lose it. Now, I got to make a distinction here too, okay? I'm trying to nuance things here. There's a difference between hoarding and saving, and the Bible makes it absolutely clear that there is a time to save. If you look at it, Proverbs 6 through 8 says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard, consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer, ruler, yet it stores provisions in the summer and gathers its food at harvest." And Luke 14, when Jesus talks about even being a disciple, says, "Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it?" It's smart for us to save money. There's nothing wrong with having a 401k and retirement and saving. That is a wise thing, okay? But what James wants to challenge us to think about is, and what we need to wrestle with is, are we so tight-handed with our money that we aren't generous? Are we so bound up on our things that we hoard them and never ever share them? If I think of it in this terms, I got to admit that this attitude can easily sink into my own life more than I'd like to admit. I think I shared this story in a sermon a couple years ago, but I remember when Steph and I first got our house, okay? We bought our first house, and I mean, I was like 30-some years old, and I remember walking up the stairs one night and being like terrified that I had not locked the door. I was like, "Oh, wait, I got to lock the front door." Now, I'd love to sit here and say it was because I was worried about my security, right? But as I thought about it, as I went up again, the reason had nothing to do with my security. It had the fact that I had just bought a new TV, big screen TV that was sitting right next to the door. And I wanted to protect that thing, right? Now, is it bad for me to lock my door? No, that's wise. But I had to admit that that TV had a stronger grip on me than I would ever care to admit. I have to admit, there's times when I don't want to share my stuff, right? I mean, if I have a neighbor who comes over and I may need a tool and he asks for it, I may say, "I like my stuff. I don't want you to mess with it," right? That's hoarding. That's holding tightly. Now, there's wisdom there. If your neighbor keeps on giving you your tools, never gives you tools back, or he gives them back busted, maybe not a wise thing, right? But the reality is there's a spirit you can have of generosity or doing it. Maybe you hold your home tightly or a certain room or a certain chair and no one else can sit in that chair. Now, I have my recliner, okay? And I got to fight that attitude because I fought many times with my dad over, "This is my chair. No, I can sit here." But the reality is, and so I let my daughter sit in my chair, okay? But we hold stuff more tightly than we would like to. We can hoard it. And it's not always this attitude where we don't go. Maybe we can be generous, okay? But the reality is even in our generosity, we can be so kind of frustrated by it, that we hold on to things more tightly than we think. Maybe somebody's car breaks down and they ask you for a ride and you give it because you feel guilty or you don't want to come off as that kind of guy. But the reality is every time you're driving to go pick them up, the dollar signs are ticking about how much this gas is going to cost you or the amount of time. And so really what you're looking at is you're giving, but you're still holding it pretty tightly. And what James wants to say is this kind of an attitude can eat us up and it can have a negative impact. And again, I want to make it absolutely clear that your bank account doesn't necessarily dictate this. Some of the most generous people I know are some of the wealthiest. When I was an engineer up in Linden, I knew some people who literally were one of the biggest home builders in Bellevue. They drove Jaguar cars. They had four homes, and one of their homes in Linden was this huge estate. They built a grandiose barn for their grandkids because all their family members lived on the estate. You know how much money, I mean, I don't know how much money they gave, but they gave a ton to different causes. I mean, they supported more missionaries and more churches and more individual people going on different things than you would know. And that barn that you could look at and go, man, that's pretty extravagant that you build this big, huge barn for your kids who are only there, you know, half the time. They let everybody go play pickup basketball there. And every week they housed one of the best worship times for single adults. Those are people who God blessed with a huge stack of cash. But they didn't hold it tightly, they held it openly. Their houses, half the time they were occupied by people who were doing different things. I myself got keys to just go live there for like weeks when I had to go to school. So you can look at them and go, man, you got three houses or this, this, and that, and you can judge them. But the reality is, they didn't hold it that tightly. I know people who can barely make ends meet. But if one of their neighbors, if they find out they're lonely, they don't even think about it. They invite them over to have a meal, and they're willing to sacrifice. Money doesn't even come into play. Why? Because they don't hold it tightly. They hold it openly. And it may mean they got to eat ramen noodles the next week because their budget just isn't great. Our bank accounts don't dictate this. But what James wants us to see is he wants to challenge us to look in the mirror. And it's a hard thing to look at. Even think of it this way. How easy is it for us to hoard even amongst our own families? One of the things that drives me nuts is when you see some, okay, I'm going to pick on guys because I'm a guy, but I see a dad who drives the coolest Land Rover, you know, everything's blinged out, and you see their wife drive some beat up old station wagon, right? Or you can see a wife who needs to have that immaculate kitchen and everybody else has to suffer. You don't have the money to do everything else. I mean, we can play this game even internally. Is there anything wrong with a Land Rover or a nice kitchen? No. But if we're hoarding it and other people have to suffer, James says that maybe we put our hope on things or money and the generous spirit hasn't really sinked in. What he's trying to tell us and what he's trying to point out is that Christians should be generous because God has been generous to us. He said it in the very beginning that in James 1, 16 and 17, don't be deceived, my dear brothers. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change in the shifting shadows. See, when we put our faith in God and when we have this proper understanding of who He is, and we looked at His sovereignty last week, we understand that everything we have is a gift from God. That our funds and our talents and everything is a gift. And so we can hold it lightly because it's not about us and what we did, but it's about God and what He's done. We don't have to worry about, well, what if we give away this dollar? Because we trust that God will give us enough. I think about it. There were times when Steph and I were first married where she was working for YD Adventures and we literally got like $900 that month. My rent was $700. My car insurance and stuff was $100 and cell phone. And, you know, everything else was about $200. If you look at it, we didn't know how we'd have money for food, but God provided, whether it was a part-time job or those. If I look at the life of Crossway Church, every time we've dropped support, God's brought people. And it's been amazing. And there's a trust there that James wants us to have. Don't be deceived. He says everything is a good gift. And the ultimate gift that he's given us is Jesus Christ. And he says this, if any of you have, in Philippians, Paul says, if any of you have encouragement from being united with Christ, any comfort from his love, if any fellowship with the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility, consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should not look only to your own interests, but to the interests of others. Your attitude should be the same as Christ Jesus, who, being in the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God as something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking on the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man. He humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. You think about somebody who had the ultimate ability to hoard. Jesus was in heaven. I mean, Jesus had everything at his fingertips. But he gave it all up. For you and for me. He came to earth as a baby. I mean, he had every power imaginable, and he puts himself in this finite little baby body. And he has to deal with life here on earth, which is not always easy. And his life on earth, what we're going to celebrate in 2 weeks, wasn't great. I mean, you look at what he endured in his final weeks, it was brutal. But he didn't hold it tightly. He held it with open hand. So what James wants us to see is when we've been impacted by the love of Christ, that's how we hold things as well. It's not a money issue, it's a heart issue. So, do you hold on to your money and your things tightly, or do you hold them with an open hand and a willingness to share? And this one's the tough one. I had to ask myself, what things do you hold tightly? Because some stuff we just don't care, right? But there's certain things that we hold dear. James just wants to say, hey, how much is the love of Christ and that attitude of his selfless giving impacted you? He says another thing. There's another litmus test that we can have when we really examine our lives and the amount of greed and a desire for things can take over. And he says this, that we don't care for others, we take advantage of them. We trample over them rather than offering a hand up. You can see it there in verse 4. He says, look, the wages you failed to pay the workmen who mowed your fields and crying out against you, the cries of your harvesters have reached out to the Lord Almighty. And the point that he's trying to make is, again, just like we can hold money tightly or open-handed, we can either push people down to get what we think we need, or we can help people up. And that's really what James is challenging us to do. Sometimes when we look at a verse like this, we can go, hey, look, I'm not a business owner, so the reality is I don't have to worry about it. And if you're a business owner, obviously this verse says, hey, look, you need to think about paying wages that are fair. But again, think about this, guys. I mean, James isn't just interested. He's not talking to a certain class. He's trying just to challenge us to think about those subtle ways that greed can enter our lives. So when we have that experience at a restaurant and the waitress was really great and we have the ability to give them a tip, do we think things through and do we look at it and go, man, I know that waitresses are some of the most underpaid, undervalued people out there. And am I going to cringe at writing that extra 5% of a tip? I mean, you know, that $1.50 or $2? I mean, it's in the little things. I remember a church in Seattle said that when the waitresses in that church hated a certain church because the people hung out for hours after the service and they didn't tip at all. And that was the witness that the churches were giving. The reality is that we can hoard and we can take advantage. It's so easy for us to do. Maybe it's even we miss opportunities. You got somebody who's out of work in your neighborhood and you know that they would love to earn a little bit of cash by mowing your lawn, and their rate isn't even that bad. And you know, really, you probably have the $25 to hire that person. But you're cheapskate. And so you say, they'll fend for themselves, when you had an opportunity to be a blessing. I'm preaching to myself here, guys. These are like my real life examples. But the reality is, it's so easy for us to have that attitude of not seeing funds as an ability to be generous and to be kind and to be gracious. And that we use it as an opportunity to help others. It doesn't mean we have to help everybody, okay? That's not our job. But the reality is I think we have more opportunities to be generous than we think. And that we avoid them because money can have a higher grip on our hearts than we would care to admit. So, are you willing to trample over people for the sake of a buck? Or do you look at opportunities to use it to lift people up? I get this is a heavy sermon. And some of you may be feeling like, hey, look, here's the deal. I'm not the one with money, and I'm not the one creating this injustice. And so James actually, if you look at it, turns his attention pretty abruptly in verse 7 to change the subject. We'll come back to 6. Don't worry about that. But he says, look, I want to give you, if you feel like you're fighting injustice, some encouragement, and I also want to give you some warnings. And so maybe you feel like, man, I'm not in that spot where I feel like I'm struggling with greed. I feel like I'm getting taken by the man over and over and over again. Well, James got a words to you as well. And he's got a words of encouragement and warning. In verse 7 he says, the encouragement is this, be patient and remember that the Lord is coming. I mean, look at that verse. He says, be patient then, brothers, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop and how patient it is for the autumn, spring, rains to come. You too, be patient and stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. And he gives examples there of the prophets and of Job. And what he says is, I understand that sometimes it feels like you're fighting injustice and that life is treating you badly and that you're suffering. And if you're feeling that, the encouragement that he wants to give you is to be patient and remember that the Lord is coming again. That the injustice that you're fighting is not the end of the story. I grew up in Iowa. My dad is a, soon-to-be retired professor here in a few months, and a farmer. And every spring he plants seeds, and every summer he waits until the fall to see once what rains are going to happen and what's going to happen. And he plants the crops, and he doesn't know if he's going to get a bumper harvest or if it's going to be a drought. And what James says is, you and I are like that. Sometimes we don't know what's going to happen in our lives, but we can hold out because we know that in the end, Christ is coming. And it may feel brutal as we're waiting to see this happen, and it may stretch everything we want to do to trust Him. And we may feel like we have doubts, but He says, remember and be patient because the Lord is coming near. He says, look at the examples of the prophets. These guys, you want a group of people that were treated unjustly? Half these prophets wanted to die. They spoke the words of God and they suffered greatly. Job, I mean, just read through the book what this guy went through. He lost his fortune and his family. But he patiently endured, and at the end, he says, God, in you I put my trust, and I have something even sweeter than I could have ever imagined. And so if we're suffering, that's the encouragement for us today, that the Lord is coming again and that we can be patient. And that we can put our hope in that. But he didn't just give warnings to those who are wealthy or creating injustice. He also gives some pretty big words of warning to those who are suffering injustice. And what he says is, watch your own life. When we fight and we feel like injustice is happening to us, when we feel like our spouses or our parents or our boss or our employees are treating unfairly, it's pretty easy for us to have an attitude disconnect, isn't it? I mean, we can kind of think like, well, they're creating this injustice to me so I can do whatever I want. And what James wants to tell us is, just as he's challenging the rich to be generous with the things they have, we need to be generous if we're fighting injustice with our attitude and with our hope and with our love. And we need to be making sure that we're not doing injustice as well. Instead of just becoming a victim of injustice, we can easily become a vehicle of injustice towards others if we aren't careful. And so he highlights two attitudes. First, don't grumble against one another. How easy it is when we're ticked for us to just let it go, right? I'm preaching to myself here, okay? And it doesn't even have to be an external thing, right? Where we grumble against people. We can do this internally, and sometimes internally it's even worse. Because then when we let people know that we're ticked at them, we just don't say it. And so they're left guessing. But the reality, what James wants to urge us to do is when we feel like we're a victim, to not grumble against one another, to be careful about it. And he says it in the end, be careful about your words. You want a piece of advice? Your mom and your grandma and your dad and your grandpa probably told you this at the beginning. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it at all, right? What he says is, above all, brothers, do not swear, not by heaven or by earth or by anything. Let your yes be yes and your no, no. Don't grumble, not even against God or against other people. But be careful about your words, because when you feel injustice, you have the temptation to fight back. And when you do, you're not just being a victim of injustice, but you're communicating it to other people. I don't know about you, but the thing about James, I love the book of James and I love this series, but at the same time, when I sit through a passage like this and I prepare, I hate preparing a sermon because I know that James is speaking to me. And I know that if you want to look at this list of everything I failed to do, I can be greedy, I can bite back, I can grumble, I can do everything. And I can feel like a miserable failure. But as we saw in every sermon, we're going to see it again. James says that when we feel like a failure and we feel humble, we're in the right place. Because what we do is we reach out and we look to the one place where the true hope and peace is found. And so when we fail, we need to remember God's mercy and His compassion in Jesus. And He highlights it in two different places. The first one you may not see, especially in NIV, because it says, you've condemned and murdered innocent men who are not opposing you. But the reality is, the language is, he's talking about one person. Now, translators in NIV and other Bibles have said he's talking about all men. And so these people who are fighting the man, it's the representative of everyone. But personally, I think that he's reminding the rich that their selfishness and their lack of generosity has nailed those sins to the cross of the righteous one that we look at in Jesus, and the innocent one who did not oppose you, but rather freely gave up his life. And for those of us who are having a hard time with injustice and fighting back when we feel cornered, he says, as you know, we consider blessed those who have persevered. You've heard Job's perseverance and seen what the Lord has finally brought upon you. And he reminds them that the Lord is full of compassion and mercy. So when we fail, when we look at our own hearts and we see our own brokenness and our own shame and our own failure, we remind ourselves what James reminds ourselves, that we're more broken than we could ever imagine, but we're also more loved than is beyond our dreams. And Jesus' life, and the life of the prophets, and the life of Job prove to us that even in the midst of all our difficult circumstances, and even in the midst of our failure, God's love and mercy and compassion win. That's what we celebrate. Because of what Christ did, he didn't hoard the stuff of heaven. Rather, he gave it up freely. He didn't fight injustice with injustice. Rather, he laid down his life willingly for you and for me. That's where our hope, that's where our meaning, and that's where our security is found. And that's what James wants us to understand. It's why I love that we take communion after every sermon. Because it's the tangible reminder of that truth. Christ's body was broken and his blood was shed so that you and I can spend eternity with him. And that he can change our hearts to be more generous like his. That's really what James wants us to understand today. So let's pray.